This is JS Party, your weekly celebration of JavaScript and the web.
Good news, everyone!
We just dropped Dance Party, our third full-length album, on Changelog Beats. Buy it on Bandcamp or stream it on Spotify, Apple Music, and the rest. Link in the show notes.
Enjoy the drop.
Thank you to our partners at Fly.io. Launch your app close to your users. Find out how at Fly.io. Okay, hey, it is party time, y'all.
What's up, friends? This episode of GS Party is brought to you by our friends over at Vercel. And I'm here with Lee Robinson, VP of Product. Lee, I know you know the tagline for Vercel, develop, preview, ship, which has been perfect, but now there's more after the ship process. You have to worry about security, observability, and other parts of just running an application in production. What's the story there? What's beyond shipping for Vercel?
Yeah, you know, when I'm building my side projects or when I'm building my personal site, it often looks like develop, preview, ship. You know, I try out some new features. I try out a new framework. I'm just hacking around with something on the weekends. Everything looks good. Great. I ship it. I'm done. But as we talk to more customers, as we've grown as a company, as we've added new products, there's a lot more to the product portfolio of Vercel nowadays to help pass that experience. So when you're building larger, more complex products, and when you're working with larger teams, you want to have more features, more functionality. So tangibly, what that means is features like our Vercel Firewall product to help you be safe and to have that layer of security. Features like our logging and observability tool so that you can understand and observe your application in production, understand if there's errors, understand if things are running smoothly and get alerted on those. And also then really an expansion of our integration suite as well too, because you might already be using a tool like a Datadog, or you might already be using a tool at the end of this software development lifecycle that you want to integrate with to continue to scale and secure and observe your application. And we try to fit into those as well too. So we've kind of continued to bolster and improve the last mile of delivery.
That sounds amazing. So who's using the Vercel platform like that? Can you share some names?
Yeah, I'm thrilled that we have some amazing customers like Under Armour, Nintendo, Washington Post, Zapier, who use Vercel's running cloud to not only help scale their infrastructure, scale their business and their product, but then also enable their team of many developers to be able to iterate on their products really quickly and take their ideas and build the next great thing.
Very cool. With zero configuration for over 35 frameworks, Vercel's front-end cloud makes it easy for any team to deploy their apps. Today, you can get started with a 14-day free trial of Vercel Pro or get a customized enterprise demo from their team. Visit vercel.com/changelogpod to get started. That's vercel.com/changelogpod.
Hello, JS Party people. The sound of those BMC beats means that it is once again time for your favorite party about JavaScript and the web. I'm K-Ball. I'm your MC this week. I am joined by my frequent and, after last week, I have to say, favorite co-panelist, Amel.
There we go.
Amel, how you doing?
Hey, hey. Happy to be here. Anytime I'm not host is like a good day, right? Like I said, I get to relax and just like watch you sweat it, K-Ball. So this is great.
You got it. You get to be the one poking holes and distracting us. And I'm the one who's trying
exactly,
to keep the ship
on
the track. No, it's all good. Well, this may be a very punny show because we've got a couple of great guests today. I'm going to throw out to first Mark Texan from the Angular team.
Hey, good to meet everybody. Thanks for having us on. So glad to be here.
And his partner in puns, Jessica Janik.
Hello, I'm glad to be here. Although I don't know that anybody is Mark's partner in puns. He's probably just more annoyed that I'm the one throwing the puns out all the time.
So let's get started. We have Mark and Jessica here to talk about Angular. They're both involved with the Angular team. Let's have you each introduce yourselves a little bit and tell us a little bit more about yourselves and how you got involved with Angular. we'll throw to Mark first.
Sure. So I actually started with Angular a long time ago, way back in the AngularJS days. As a developer, I was working at a healthcare company, and I was like, hey, this front-end space is going to change quite a bit. Now, we're talking almost, what, 15 years ago, right? Like, I'm like, the front-end space is going to change. And then I just hedged my bet, believe it or not. I just guessed, like, I'm going to choose Angular. There's so many options. I'm going to choose AngularJS. And I turned out to be right. And then, lo and behold, many moons later, I end up with an opportunity to actually work on the Angular team. And what's so special about that is, you know, my career changed because I chose AngularJS, and then I got to be a part of the same product that changed my career and changed my life. So it's really awesome to be a part of this team and to be a part of Google and to really have this opportunity.
Nice. How about you, Jessica?
A bit of a similar story, which is actually a common theme with Mark and I. We have an interesting background between the two of us. But the first web framework I learned, it was Knockout, if you want to call that a framework, the kind of precursor that inspired AngularJS. And then I started learning AngularJS. And then when Angular released, I built my own website out of the recently released Angular 2. And happened to be going to like Google I/O pretty regularly. And I remember one year I went and I saw a couple of women on the Angular team presenting. And I thought, man, what a couple of powerhouses doing some crazy, amazing work. Can you imagine what it would be like to work on a team with them? Gosh, like that'll never happen to me, but wow, what an amazing team. And then I ended up shockingly getting a job at Google I never expected to, and then found myself, like, after a year, I joined the Angular team through connections to one of those people that I saw give a presentation. And now I call them my colleagues, and I'm still kind of baffled, like, how did that happen? But I'm also quite grateful. And unfortunately, I have to work with this Mark Texan guy. He's just awful all the time.
The worst. I am the worst.
So amazing backstories, both of you. And I just can't believe how like similar you both are in terms of your energies, like the level of like jovialness that is on this podcast right now. It's not even able to come through on audio because, you know, you need to just see their faces and how much smiling is happening. But thank you so much for sharing that. I want to share a story with Jessica and I, because I actually got to witness the little journey that Jessica told us about. Jessica and I have a backstory. We actually ran a community together in the Boston area, and I actually met her at Google I/O many years ago, and that's how we first connected on that community. And I remember one year, I remember like her saying, yeah, I would love to give, my dream one day would be to give a talk at Google I/O. It would be to like be a part of this community. And, you know, it was just amazing to like see that happen, you know, for you, just like it was this fairy tale that you wrote for yourself. And so, I don't know, Jessica, you're like one of the nicest, kindest people that I've had the pleasure of knowing. And I just want to say you're awesome. And I'm so proud of you. And thank you for inspiring not just me, but like so many people. So just thank you.
That is so wonderful to hear. And yeah, like working with you on that community was wonderful. And I've actually missed hanging out with you and chatting with you.
Same. So. Well, yeah, you're all the way in California now, so we're just going to have to figure this out, you know? But oh, wait. Did I not. Are you back in Massachusetts?
Okay. I am back in Massachusetts.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Okay, so we've got to connect. Yeah, I've swung the other way, so we'll have to catch up. But anyways, back to Angular, everyone.
Back to Angular. Well, so I wanted to ask a little bit. We had a couple folks on from specifically the Angular Signals team recently, and Angular is a very big project. So can you maybe share a little bit about like how is the team structured and where do you all fit in? And maybe that can lead us into what we're going to talk about today with regards to Angular functionality.
Yeah. So you guys had Alex and Pavel on, didn't you? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So they're on the Angular framework team, like the core framework team. And I am also on that team. So they're my immediate colleagues. And what's interesting is people think of Angular as a big project. And it is. Like, it's definitely a big framework. But actually, the team that does the work on it is pretty small. There's several sub-teams that work on different portions of the framework. There's the core framework team. We have stuff that people that work on, like, dev infra and tooling and whatnot. So all in all, it's actually a pretty small group of people that do that work. can't remember exactly how many sub teams we have, but there's a small group. It's divided up such that we can kind of tackle things that are relevant to that specific area. So like Alex and Pavel and myself and a few other people, we work on the actual like core framework of the APIs that go out. There's some people that work on just stuff that affects how we roll out our code, and some people work on just the components. It helps us move forward as best and as quickly as we can. And then we also have our developer relations folks, which Mark, I think you might be familiar with that a little bit.
Well, I am. So that's my role. So on the team, we also have our DevRel team, which for the Angular team is really interesting because depending on who you ask and where you work, developer relations means something different. But at Google, developer relations has a technical connotation that just goes along with it. So we're technically developer relations engineers. And so we're also responsible for some code. We're responsible for some technical contributions as well. But we also do other things. Like for my work on the team, I lead our YouTube effort and I lead our blog effort. But I also wrote a bunch of the documentation. And right now I'm working on some other documents and technical contributions for some other projects that I can't talk about now. But keep your eyes open for some very special things coming along. But that's just how our team works. And so the DevRel team, you know, we're big into knowing exactly what's happening with the framework team, and we work very closely together. Jessica and I work really closely together on lots of different projects. And so I get to support projects with her in different ways. And it's been really, really special, really, really fantastic.
Yeah, I like to think of myself as an honorary DevRel team member, even though I'm not on DevRel. I do a lot of DevRel-y stuff. Like I go and do talks and stuff at conferences, and I help with the video production work. And it's a lot of fun. I appreciate the fact that on our team, we actually do a lot of cross-team collaboration. And that actually spans beyond just DevRel and like the framework. We see that happen across all of our teams where we kind of just try to help each other out as much as we can.
I feel like you're like Miss Community. You've always been Miss Community. Like, so I'm not surprised to see you like engage in the community even when you're not formally in that capacity at work, you know? So it makes sense. That's what the draw was for you. And so that's also how you engage. That's so cool.
Well, and one of the things we were commenting on in that prior episode was how strong the Angular community and engagement is. And I think a lot of that speaks to the fact that one, you have a solid DevRel team, and two, that the boundaries between relationships and community and the core development are very loose and fuzzy, and y'all are all working together. So Mark, you teased us a little bit with features you can't talk about. Let's talk about some of the features you can. So y'all suggested as a good thing to discuss a little bit about Angular's server-side rendering approach. And I'm kind of curious what you have there in terms of what does it look like today and what's exciting that you're looking to move forward into.
I would jump in and talk a little bit about what I think is really interesting. And then Jessica has a bunch of details about some of the really amazing stuff that she's worked on that can help. I'll tell you this. We as in the team, specifically Jessica and some other team members, made this new feature called Defer. And it allows you to, at the template level, right, at your component template level, do lazy loading and deferred loading of parts of your component. And the reason that's so special, because everyone says, oh, well, I can do lazy loading right now. That works in everything. Yeah, but it's at the template level. So you can do parts of your component, right, that can be lazy loaded. And that gives you so much power to optimize your application. And I feel like when we, you know, release this feature as a team, it really is going to, so we release it, and I think it's going to just set this like goalpost for other folks to continue to also develop features that are similar to that. Cause I think it's just honestly a good engineering idea, right? And the same way that we see signals as, oh, this is a good engineering idea, we're gonna use it in Angular, I think Defer will be that for the community as well. But Jessica is part of the team who led this effort. She co-led this effort. So Jessica, please tell us more about how Defer works.
Yeah, deferrable views are pretty awesome. In my honest opinion, humble opinion, I never know if it's supposed to be honest or humble.
Humble, I think. Humble.
But so like we looked at, typically nowadays when we're developing features for Angular in general, we take looks at like, okay, is this being done by another framework? How are they doing it? What do we like about what they're doing with it? What do we think is missing? How would this be like improved if we were to pull that into Angular in some way. And for deferrable views, we were definitely looking at Suspense and some of the other frameworks approach. I can't remember what Vue calls their version of it. It's like async components, I think is what they call it. And like all of it made sense, the higher order component version of it. And we originally had thought about doing defer as like a higher order kind of component for Angular or a dedicated like directive that we would use for deferring views and then like have it be at the component level. But it was suggested that, you know, maybe what if we were able to just have people like do this as a part of their template? You just declare it in the template and then whatever's inside that block gets deferred. Because when you do stuff with like Suspense, you still have to write like your manual dynamic imports and whatnot. And we were like, what if people didn't have to do that? What if people were just able to say like, here's my HTML, here's your stuff that you want to be deferred. Let's just wrap that in at defer. And then under the hood, we'll magically figure out those dependencies for you and create a separate chunk. And then you don't have to even think about it. It just kind of does that for you. And then, well, now we need some sort of intention for when those chunks are actually loaded. So we took a look at some internal stuff. We took a look at Astro having like the triggers that they have built in. And we decided to create a set of built-in similar triggers, like on interaction or on viewport or on hover, et cetera. So like right there, when you're declaring that at defer, you can put those like on interaction as when that thing will be triggered. So you have like a nice declarative way of saying like, hey, this is how this stuff will actually work. And then we were like, great, but there's still something missing here. What shows before the stuff loads? So we added another area for you to put placeholder in, a loading block, a way to handle errors. And it's just this really nice, very usable API that makes deferred loading super easy. And you can kind of combine all of those triggers. You can use multiple. You can create your own kind of custom conditions with a when clause. You can also handle prefetching with it. It's really powerful. And everybody's been really happy with it, really well received. So that's essentially what defer is, or deferrable views. And it works both with server-side rendering and client rendering. It's just awesome. I'm quite proud of that feature. Yeah, that's defer.
So I obviously have lots of different questions about this, and I'm going to be open. I have not used Angular personally in a long time, so I'm not a deep expert. I apologize. Mark, I see your face. I feel like I just admitted to something terrible.
Yeah. But, I have to hop onto this bandwagon. I managed a team that like was part of a very big Angular project. But yeah, like being a manager, like I wasn't super in the code every day. So, you know, that's about as close as I've gotten to Angular recently. But I was like a pretty big in the 1x days. I'm sure K-Ball was as well. Like, it's my guess.
Yeah. And then, but that also makes sense though, right? That there are people who looked at Angular, it did not meet their needs at the time, and then they looked at other tools. Like, that's not an unfamiliar story. What I think is so interesting now is how we've been able to take that feedback and then revitalize Angular in a very special way, right? And that's been a really big part of our 2023 story. And yeah, but we started this work way back, you know, like years ago when we had to rewrite our rendering engine, which I'm sure Pavel and Alex talked about, right? Like making that massive thing. And there was just this time of kind of, it felt like dormancy to the general public because we were doing this really big rewrite. And then now, because we have that foundation, the things that we can do now, this is why things like defer can happen. This is why things like hydration can happen. And then like our new template syntax, like the at for, at if, like did they talk about how the at for, how it speeds up template rendering so quick that we were like in like 17th place in an independent study. And now the only thing that's faster than us is like Solid and then like native JS, right? Because of all that work that we were able to do. So this is a great time for people to get back to Angular, to start just looking and seeing, hey, what are they doing over there? What's going on?
Totally. So yeah, in that view then, so making sure I understand, right now, templates are separate files in Angular. You're not doing like the single file component style thing that like a Vue does. Is that correct? Because I'm trying to understand.
No, you can.
Okay.
You can do single files if you really want, because you can actually just declare your template in the component. But Okay. Yes.
So yeah,
I mean, typically it's still a separate file.
Within your template, you're marking some part of that template as deferred. And I mean, I want to know, how are you figuring out which sets of JavaScript functions are specific to that versus actually needed in multiple places? Like if it's trigger an event handler that might be triggered from different places, like how are you, what's happening behind the hood to chunk these things out?
Well, we're doing it at compile time. So it's like, it's not like a JIT kind of behavior. So like in the compile step, we're actually analyzing all of your, like your dependency structure. And we look in the template, we see you kind of have to declare your component dependencies anyway ahead of time. So we know which components you're going to use. We can actually look at that view and figure out what's inside of that defer block and extract that out as a separate chunk, those dependencies out. It's the whole under the hood Angular. It's can, you know, under the hood in any framework is a little confusing to follow, but well, there's all these internal structures that you have to be aware of. But like, yeah, there's a lot going on, but essentially, yeah, at compile time, we're doing this analysis and,
got it,
and extracting the components out.
Are you able to, so let's imagine, and sorry, I like to geek really deep on this stuff, so I'm going to push you a little bit, but so you're pulling out the dependency chain, you say, okay, these sets of components, they're loaded below this. Now, I imagine they load some set of util functions or something like that as well. And those might, if you have, say, a set of utilities that are loaded in a couple different deferred blocks, but not anywhere else, can you pull those out separately and only load them once across your two defers? Or do they get sort of two chunks with duplication?
I can't remember exactly how this works. I think it loads once based on like the analysis that we do. Once a component is loaded, I don't think it has to be fetched again. But I don't remember, to be honest. I'd have to go back and look through that code base.
Interesting. And then with the server side, are you rendering, if you render a deferred block server side, does it just do the placeholder or will it go through things but then defer the, okay, so it just does the place. Interesting. Because some of this sounds a lot like how Quick does things, where they're trying to sort of identify which sets of things can be done, have to be done up front, and which sets of things are essentially deferrable or resumable in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, I would say this is very much in line with, I think, what Powell and Alex were talking to us last time we spoke with them, which was very recently, actually. So we've gone from like almost no Angular content in like a few years to like having two amazing Angular shows back to back. It's fantastic.
Let's go.
Let's do this.
Let's go.
They were talking about like how essentially there's, you know, really all, you can kind of categorize all frameworks into two buckets, right? Ones that do dirty checking and ones that don't. And I think, Mark, the speed gain that you speak of, you know, going from 17th to like basically second/first at this point, you know, first, if you think about like frameworks that have extremely wide adoption, right? You know, Solid is fantastic, you know, huge thought leader, but obviously you can't compare the adoption of Solid and Angular. And so like this paradigm shift where Angular used to do dirty checking, which is also what React does with the virtual DOM tree, you know, you're able to kind of, you do that calculation upfront to figure out what needs to be watched. And then any changes are very scapular. You're not like going through your whole DOM tree, like looping through and figuring out stuff. So that's pretty cool. I was just curious, like with deferred views, like how did, I mean, I'm sure given like the scale of Angular, people were doing this before there was kind of built-in support for deferred views. And so like, how were they doing this kind of lazy loading pattern before this kind of built-in primitive?
I think the short answer is a lot of custom complexity. It was a challenging thing to do. Like at best, the easiest thing people were doing was lazy loaded routes, which is something we've supported for a long time. But if anybody ever wanted to do any sort of deferred dependency fetching, there were a lot of barriers in the way. So it wasn't common. We'll just say that, like, that's probably the easiest way to put it. There were some utilities out there, they were complex, very hard to follow, had a really difficult developer experience. And we knew people were having challenges with how can I reduce my initial bundle size? And like, we'd been quite frankly asked for something like this for a long time. It was just a matter of when we could actually prioritize it. The whole thing that's like, Mark mentioned the speed improvements, but the new control flow, part of the reason why it's so much faster, well, actually, one of the main reasons why, is because what we were doing before, we had these structural directives. If you're not familiar with Angular, we have this kind of directive system. And a structural directive is like a special type of directive. You can only use one per element. And if you know anything about Angular syntax, it's anytime you have to like put star in front of an attribute on a component, be like star ng4 equals blah, blah, blah. That's something called a structural directive. And it was initially built that way because we wanted people to be able to build their own and like customize to their heart's content. That came at the cost of performance. It also came at the cost for at least control flow with some DX. Like just in general, the DX around for loops and if-then and trying to do if-then-else was awkward. So the whole control flow improvements like solved that significantly, along with making it native rather than having it something that is injected as a directive. We were able to improve the performance significantly. We don't have to go through the whole directive matching process. Yeah. So that's a big reason why.
You're getting to what one of my questions would be is why now? And it sounds like it was kind of unlocked by this change in control flow.
Yeah, that's where that performance bump came from. The control flow thing, like we knew we wanted to do that for quite a while as well. And actually we hadn't planned on doing that when we did, but as we were writing out defer, we realized that it would be ideal if we could use the syntax we were thinking about for control flow. And in order to do that, we didn't want to introduce defer as the thing that introduced this new syntax. People were going to be like, what is this new syntax? I've never seen this in Angular before. So we decided to pair it with control flow so that it all kind of meshed and made sense. And I think that was hugely successful for us.
Are there other new functionality that have been rolled out in this sort of control flow way or that take advantage of that new approach to thinking about it?
At least from this, like the block syntax perspective, no, not yet. But there will very likely be other things that take advantage of that block syntax. We've talked about a few, but nothing that has been like actively prioritized yet that we would actually start working on. But I think the syntax is great. But the thing that I think is funny is that the at syntax that we're using, which is actually inspired by Razor syntax, was not our first choice. The Angular team really actually likes Svelte syntax. So we had originally gone with, like if you go back and look at our RFC for it, you'll see all this Svelte syntax that's in there. But our community actually preferred Razor. And we did a bunch of like user research and got strong feedback that the Razor syntax was more preferred, so we switched to that instead, by a razor's edge.
What's up, friends? I'm here with Conrad Hoffmeyer from PowerSync. PowerSync is the sync layer that enables an offline-first architecture to make your application real-time and reactive. Conrad, why is offline-first, local-first a big deal right now for developers?
We're really excited about local-first as a movement, and we think it's going to become the default architecture for a very large number of apps that are going to be built going forward, just because it has really big benefits for both developers and end users. So taking a step back, just looking at what local-first is, so it's an architecture where your app code works directly with a client-side embedded database, which then automatically syncs with a backend database in the background. That's compared to cloud-first apps, where they mostly use a cloud data store via APIs. That has some really big benefits for developers and end users. having a local database and syncing with the cloud in the background. The biggest benefit for end users is that everything in the app feels instant because the app is working with a local database and you don't have to do round trips to the cloud. There's no loading spinners. Everything can just load instantly. It also means that the apps can be always available for the most part, regardless of connection. So even if the user goes offline, the app is always available. So like you said, you know, if you have a momentary lapse in connectivity, if you're driving through a tunnel or if you're on the subway or if you're out in a rural area, you don't have latency and the app can just keep on working and loading data out of the local database.
So this move to an offline first architecture, what are the biggest benefits for developers?
The biggest benefit for developers is that it really simplifies state management. So state management is a headache for most apps. Developers typically work with some kind of state management library or framework. There's a lot of kind of finicky aspects to it. But with local first, the global state is simply stored in the local database, like a SQLite database. And that really simplifies the app code. It keeps your logic really simple and functional because your UI basically just reflects the content of the database. So it just makes everything a lot simpler. And then there's other benefits for developers too. Since you're working with data and logic locally, your backend becomes simpler. You have to do less API development on the backend. You can shift a lot of stuff to the front end. A lot of working with the data, manipulating the data and logic. And they also reduce your backend compute load and compute cost and your dependency on the backend in general. So it kind of takes the backend API off the critical path for the user using the application.
I like it. Very cool. What's your goal with PowerSync?
Our goal with PowerSync is to be framework agnostic and eventually even backend database agnostic, but we already support Flutter, React Native, JavaScript for web apps. Kotlin SDK is right around the corner. Our web SDK plays well with any JavaScript framework, including Next.js. Yeah, the goal is to be framework agnostic, and we will also be becoming increasingly backend database agnostic. So supporting additional backend databases, not just Postgres, but also Microsoft SQL Server, MySQL, etc. But there's a ton of applications that can communicate with the cloud asynchronously, where you can primarily work with a local database. And therefore, we think for the majority of apps, local first will become sort of the default architecture.
Okay, the next step is to head to powersync.com/changelog to learn more. Take your application offline first for free with PowerSync using their free tier. No credit card required. Again, powersync.com/changelog.
So I guess like maybe switching into kind of Angular support for server-side rendering, could you tell us the story of like, because when Angular 1x was first rolled out, there was the, you know, it was in the SPA revolution days, right? So like that was kind of, it was pretty famously a single page, a framework for building incredible single page apps. And so when did that like transition to kind of SSR support happen? And then like, it seems like that's maybe something that the framework is like really seriously reinvesting in now. And so
it's a universal story.
Is it? Yeah, pretty much. Jessica. Literally, right? Yeah.
So if you think about the way technology works in general, there's this pendulum that swings over time, right? So when we all started writing web apps, we all did the same thing. We wrote our code probably in Perl. If you did it early enough, you were writing your like web applications in Perl, and then you were uploading to CGI-bin on some server via FTP. That's what we all did, right? So everything was server-side rendered. And then, you know, like you said, when the you know, Angulars of the world and other tools started this like single page application, we're like push everything to the front end. And then we were like, we're going to forsake the entire like server side rendering story. Like everyone does this, right? And then now we're like, well, the pendulum's swinging again. Like, oh, what if we were to go back? And so for Angular, we've had server side rendering for a long time in terms of the platform. If for, Jessica says a universal story, it started off as this thing called Angular Universal, which was a contribution from the community. Actually, somebody, you know, the community members wrote Angular Universal, which gave us server-side rendering. However, it was limited server-side rendering. We called it like this term that, this is Jessica's favorite term for this. We called it destructive hydration, where we would render the website, right? But it'd be kind of like almost like a static site with no functionality. Then we'd destroy the DOM, literally erase everything, and then re-render it with Angular, like an attached event handlers, get everything working. But then over the last year, we've introduced just a better server-side rendering story, hybrid rendering story with static site generation, server-side rendering, and now hydration, where we have like actual hydration. So that's really changed the game for us as we're continuing to like move
not move with the times because we can't chase every trend, right? Like as a framework, we just cannot look at every single thing and say, yes, we're going to do that. We're going to do that. We're going to do that. We have to prioritize things based on the needs of our users and where the industry is going, but within respect to still serving our users and staying true to our identity as a framework. So now we've looked at it and said, yeah, it makes sense to do server-side rendering. It makes sense to invest the time to make hydration work. It makes sense to do things like defer. So all this stuff makes sense for Angular, and we truly try to find a place where we can move things for everyone. And so we're some places we're catching up, and some places I think we're innovating.
Yeah, that destructive hydration was the story of server-side rendering for a number of years everywhere, right? And it creates that whole, like, I don't remember what it was, but the uncanny valley of, it looks like I can interact with this thing. Why can't I interact with it? So something you said there led me to a question. So I think one of the, we are obviously seeing much more innovation in terms of number of front-end frameworks these days. And there's people like Solid, and I keep coming back to Qwik because I love their technology story, but and then Astro, who's really like getting tons of adoption, like all these different people pushing the boundaries in different ways. And a lot of it comes down to sort of thinking about what are the core unsolved problems right now for front-end developers. And I'm curious what your sort of take or perspective is on that, and particularly, you know, from the Angular community. Like, what are the big needs that the Angular community has right now that are not being met?
I'll tell you the first need, and we're working on this, but for the Angular community specifically, you know, there's a performance need that, okay, let's go back a little bit back in time. So we do change detection, which is figuring out which thing needs to be re-rendered on the screen at what time. We do it based on this thing called zones. And I think Alex and Pablo probably touched on this already, but you know, this is still one of those core needs, right? We're doing this thing called zones, and it's really magical when you think about it. If I told you there's a framework where you can just update your properties in your class and component, and we will figure out what needs to change, that would make you super happy probably. Because think about the developer experience around that. There is no use state. There is no set state. There's nothing. You just change stuff. Update, and we'll handle the rest. We thought it was a good idea too, right? We're like, yeah, this is good.
That's the premise of all these like purely state-driven UI frameworks, and they're incredible in theory.
In theory, exactly. In theory, but at scale, guess what we found out? Becomes problematic at scale. And then a lot of the Angular community, some of our, we have very large customers, right? Like that, like large airlines, large enterprises, you know, huge customers. And they're like, hey, at scale, this kind of sucks a little bit. Not going to lie to you. This kind of sucks. And so that's why our reactivity story is starting to become, you know, this main focus with the whole signals thing, right? Where signal-based components, where the change detection is based on those signals model. So that's meeting our big user need, because again, people are like, we love Angular. We love the fact that you can, out of the box, we give you everything. You don't have to go search for a router. Why? Why are you searching for a router? You don't spend your time on that. You don't have to go searching for lazy loading. You need to spend your time on that, right? We're not going to tell you to do anything like that. Like, we give you so much. But then that came at a cost with some architectural decisions that we thought were good in the beginning, and now we're finding what the limitations are.
I can probably add to that in terms of, like, part of that is that our learning journey along the way has actually been a bit of a challenge for new people coming to Angular. And a lot of the architectural decisions we're making right now kind of fall into us being aware that that learning journey is a challenge because the decisions we made before are not necessarily easy for new people to come pick up. And so things like zones, things like our control flow situation, but like signals was a big part of that too, because we know that a lot of people come into an existing Angular project and they see all this RxJS syntax that can be, like, let's be honest, RxJS can be really confusing when you look at how it's written in a lot of these applications. And oftentimes they're writing it that way in order to try to be as performant as possible. But in doing so, it's harder to follow. And it can be a little difficult. And by a little, I mean a lot difficult for some people who want to come in and possibly learn it. So it maybe turns people off to the idea of spending time with Angular. So I think improving that user learning journey has been a big part of shaping the direction that we are going as a framework.
I mean, a lot of this, it strikes me as sort of the classic, I think of it as an Adobe problem, right? Where you have these like expert users who are trying to do really complex things, and you support them really, really well at the cost of your product, or in this case, framework, becoming much harder for beginners to adopt and understand. And Mark, to your point, like Angular has always been the batteries included framework. They give you everything. And there are pros and cons to that. That's often, or that hasn't been the JavaScript community's approach to many things, sometimes to their detriment, but definitely, you know, has made Angular this kind of choice that often makes sense if you're in an environment where you don't want to be making all those choices. You just want a standard. You want a norm. You want people to be able to come and go and understand how the pieces are going to work, like a large enterprise or something like that. I do think there is this interesting balance that you're talking about of supporting those users and their needs while making the on-ramp easier for folks. And I think there's a whole thought process there I'd love to dig into. But before we go down another road, Amel, what did you want to cover with Mark?
Yeah, no, it really dovetails very well into what you just shared, Kbal, because for me, like, there's this interesting design principle that I came across while working on an MIT Scratch project. And it was that, you know, there's the philosophy of like when you're designing an API, you should kind of think about like low floors so that like it's easy for everyone to get started. You think of like wide walls so that like you can do lots of different things with it. And you think of like high ceilings because you don't want to hold back power users, right? And so it's this, you know, Angular is this interesting framework where there's this huge legacy, lots of enterprise users. And there's also just people who are looking at things that are happening across the web. I think we're seeing a lot of simplification of APIs, right? There's just a lot of like swing back to simplicity, right? I think Signals is also just like feeding into that story very well for Angular. And so it's really interesting to hear you talk about these tensions. And for me, like, and I've always, you know, at least in recent years, thought of Angular as like the framework for enterprise, doing like proper enterprise JavaScript development, in the sense that like, if I'm working on a project that's, you know, has multiple engineers, you know, over multiple years, you know, and I really just, I don't want to have like spaghetti code at the end. Like, I'm going to opt that we use Angular actually, right? Because there's just so much convention. And for me, like, this like platform, like I feel like Angular is a platform, and I'm just curious if you both think about it in that way, where it's just like you said, Mark, like there's no need to go look for a router. There's no need to look for like, oh, how do, like, even when you have new releases, you guys have code mods that like do a lot of automation for you, you know, and give you that tailwind. You know, there's modules for the modules. Like, there's like everything you could think of and then some, right? Like the kitchen sink framework is like what I think of with Angular. And I don't know, framework feels like the wrong word in that sense. It really just feels like a platform, you know. I'm curious to hear from both of you on that.
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely viewed as the opinionated framework. I don't know about platform, framework. To me, I think either applies. I definitely know that one of the reasons that we are so strong in the enterprise space, it's because of the fact that we don't break people. The whole thing you were talking about with code mods, or we call them migrations, essentially, we have to be very careful with breaking changes, because we've made that mistake in the past, right? I feel like Vue is starting to learn this exact same thing. Mm-hmm. They had there was a recent blog post about the Vue 3 transition and this exact sort of situation. So it's just something that we learned in the Angular 2 days.
Learned through pain.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I think the fact that we also have Google actually running, you know, thousands of Angular apps is a huge benefit for mm-hmm, enterprise mm-hmm. users as well. They know that, like, hey, like, a Google uses Angular. That means it must be a really safe framework to use if I want to make sure that my uptime is going to be reliable. I'm not going to be broken. Mm-hmm. And like, we have to make sure, like, Google's famously a monorepo, so like, we can't break people. And that means that we can't break you really either. So we put a lot of effort into that to make sure that if we're going to make something that is a breaking change, we find a way to migrate people. We see it as not really having a choice in that. We have to make sure that people are still up and running. So, and if we don't do that, we end up running into the problem of like leaving people behind, which is something that is not within Angular's like worldview. We don't leave people behind. It would be such a shame if, you know, in Angular 16, we released hydration and, you know, it'd be years before anybody could actually use it. So yeah, it's a big factor in how we think through things.
Well, and I think something really interesting there is, at least right now, like very commonly when folks have this very sort of bring people along mindset, it results in them being very conservative and not making big changes and not trying new things too much. And it's part of the sort of natural stagnation curve of technology things where, you know, early on you're doing something new and innovative, you don't have many people, you iterate really quickly, and then you get something that works, lots of people adopt it, and you slow down because you have to, you can't break everyone. What seems interesting to me here is that based on what I'm hearing, both, you know, the conversation we had before, this conversation, like y'all are starting to move fast again, but still with this mindset of introducing new capabilities without breaking people.
Move fast and don't break things. Wow. It's like, who knew?
Who knew? And so here's where I think that comes from for us. We learned such a hard lesson between Angular JS 1.x and then Angular 2, right? We learned such a hard lesson. And I think we just don't want to go back there. And then over time, as you practice, so think about practicing anything that's challenging, right? So making a souffle is pretty hard at first, right? You get a regular cook in there, or somebody who doesn't really cook, you say, make a souffle, they can't really do it. But if you make souffles every day, what happens? You get really efficient at doing it, and then you learn techniques to make the process better. We have learned over time how to make optional upgrades as a part of our path, how we can move at this speed. Because think about all the things that we've talked about in this conversation. Everything is opt-in. Everything that we've talked about is opt-in. Even the one line change to make hydration work in your application is an opt-in, and it's only one line, right? We've just gotten really good at that. Like, that has just become a part of our core ethos of how we develop software on the Angular team. And it's just, we just gotten really good at it. That sounds really arrogant. I'm not talking about myself. I'm talking about the team. Okay. So I can say this because I really do believe in the work that we do and the people who do this work. And so that's given us a really good opportunity. So if you also think about, we are able to release major features in minor releases because of the way that we work. As of 17.2, so in React, you have props. Props are immutable, and then that's how you pass in values to components, right? To customize your components. We have something called inputs. And inputs were something, right? They were kind of mutable, not supposed to be. Then you could mute them. Then if you want to track any changes, it was just really weird, right? And then people had lots of workarounds to handle it, right? We just released signal-based inputs in Angular 17.2. That is a major feature in a minor release that you get to opt into when you're ready. As long as you stay up to date with Angular, as you're ready, you get to opt into it. And we'll do the same things when signal-based components are ready, right? You'll be able to opt into it. If you go to Angular, let's say Angular 30, whenever, we don't give out dates for releases because we release things when they're ready. That is just how we work. Right. So whenever it's ready.
A whole bunch of software devs just got real jealous.
It is a privilege that we get to work like that. I will say that.
Yeah.
It is a privilege.
I think one of the things that's also helping us move faster is the developer preview concept. We have started utilizing developer preview for all of our new stuff. And like typically what happens when you release a new API, people start using that API. And now if you, like in your initial release, you did something wrong and you want to change it, you're stuck with waiting on a deprecation cycle. So you have to deprecate the original thing, create the new thing, give people time so that they can switch over to the new thing, then remove the deprecated thing. So we've created this thing called developer preview that we've started using for the past couple of years. And what that label has meant, like what it means is basically like, this is like a solid feature. It's developed, but we reserve the right to make breaking changes until we remove dev preview from it. Doesn't mean you can't use it in production. For example, like hydration was developer preview for a whole major version and people were using it in production. What it means is we may make breaking changes to this API. We probably won't, but we may. So, you know, just be aware of that. And I think because of that, we've been able to put these things out there, get a sense for what people like and don't like, see what's working, what's not working, make quick changes before we announce it as like, this is stable now. You can use these APIs as is. It's helped a lot.
So I love this. And it feels like, and there's actually a lot of similarities. Mark, when you're reminding me, or you're talking about not waiting for major releases to introduce major features, it reminded me of the Ember JS approach that they used back in the day, where they would actually release all of their new features are in minor versions. Major versions were only for when they were getting rid of something, where there was something that wasn't going to work anymore. So they would deprecate, they would do things, and then at a major, they would actually cut out something that had been deprecated for several cycles or something like that. And it had some of these same, very similar effects of like, you're only introducing backwards incompatibility in those major, but you're giving people good stuff they can try, they can opt into. Jessica, I love what you're saying about kind of the way that you've managed to separate the fast iteration exploratory piece and getting feedback from, okay, this is something that you can count on and build into your everything. And Mark, yeah, I would love to hear a little bit about kind of your journey to getting to where you are today and where you drew those inspirations, what you tried and didn't work. Like, what did that look like to get to this state, which once again feels very much like Angular, this like old, steady, reliable workhorse is now innovating at a pace to keep up with the new guns.
Yeah, a lot of that comes from the fact that we are an evidence-driven team, right? We look at evidence. We listen to feedback. We read. So when we put out a survey, for example, we read the feedback and we analyze
what?
It.
What?
I know. It's bananas that we actually do that. And when we listen to the community. And one of the things that we heard a ton about, Jessica mentioned this, it is so hard to learn Angular. Like, we've heard that over and over again. The examples are not good. Documentation's too dense, too terse. So then we come up with, my colleague Emma Torsky led this effort for Angular.dev, which is our new website for Angular developers. New features in browser tutorials, brand new tutorials written from scratch. Now, my background is in education and engineering. So I worked as a senior software engineer for many years, but I also taught in computer science at universities, right? And one of the things that I learned is how people learn. And here's what developers are not good at. We're not really good at teaching because we take so many things for granted, for example, that we understand. We'll throw out concepts. We'll just say, well, this is simple. Simply do this. Just do this. None of that means anything if I don't understand what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Nothing is simple for me in that way. So then we...
all the context we've built up over the years.
Exactly. So then we went back to the drawing board and said, what does a new learning journey look like? Right. To just continue to go along with this. We're innovating, right, in features. But we have to innovate in what we train developers. So we just started doing all kinds of stuff like that. So we looked at the new learning journey. And then one of the critical things we wanted to do was let you build the examples in the browser that you could go through, spend, a couple of hours and get a fundamental breakdown of how Angular works by trying things. Kind of like do you remember the website codeschool.com? I loved Code School. I loved that work. I think they set a standard that everyone should follow. And I know that we drew inspiration from those types of things too. Being able to learn and do in the browser, learn by doing. That was their big thing, learn by doing. And so we've adopted that for our learning journey now.
That's awesome. I mean, you want to basically reduce the friction. You don't want someone focused on learning how a bundler works and how to get TypeScript to compile. Like, you want folks like learning Angular, right? Like, that you want them to learn how to use these APIs and play around with them and like reduce the friction. And it's kind of nice, right? Because like, once you're ready to take on that friction, have at it, right? But it doesn't have to be the first like thing that you deal with when you're trying to learn this thing. And so glad to hear that. And great shout out to Code School. Like, it was like such an innovative leader, like, because it was doing that stuff like over a decade ago, and
it's like, no, you're right, like so long ago. I just want to give them so much like love and support, because when I was making that shift, because I was an enterprise Java developer for years,
I apologize,
and
just kidding,
man, enterprise Java beans and facades and all these patterns and Spring and Hibernate and all these words, right? But I just remember, like, when I was switching to front end, I went to Code School. I literally went to Code School. I paid for the subscription and I would do as many courses as I could because it was such good content. I actually dreamt of being an instructor on Code School someday, but then I think they sold and then it no longer exists. But
I love the way you're kind of leaning into that learning journey. And it's something that I think the JavaScript, you as a batteries included framework, have an advantage there that a lot of things in the JavaScript community don't have. It reminds me back to when I was first learning Ruby on Rails, and Ruby on Rails was a server side thing, but it was had that same kind of batteries included, we'll do everything. And what that lets you do is you can focus on a thing at a time. You can follow a recipe and say, okay, right now we're focused on this thing. How do, in that case, models work, maybe in Angular, how do templates work? And everything else will just work. You don't have to customize it, and you get a functioning application. And you have that story with Angular in a way that, like in React, I might just focus on a thing, but then I need create React app, or I need Next, or I need something, and like all these different things before I can get to something that I can show and play with.
So before I was on the Angular team, this is a true story. I built a company as a startup and did not make any money. I did not get rich, hence me still working, right? No successful exit. I guess I got a job at Google as an exit. So let me explain. I was teaching React and I was coding in React. And then I was like, oh, let me use React Native to make my mobile app. And the reason I actually stopped using React Native was because I started to have to do research on a routing situation. I was like, so do I use Airbnb's router? Do I use the, I think it was React Training had a router. Like all these different orgs had routers. I'm like, okay, but if I use one of their routers and a bug happens, who's responsible, right? Who's responsible for it? So then it made me literally switch to a different tool. Now that is not a slight at React because they've done a lot of very smart things, but it's just that that problem is a real problem for developers, especially when you have the experience to kind of even think like that, like who's responsible for this plugin if I'm relying on it for a major part. Right, of my application and support for that. And so, yeah, it was just like, yeah, I can't. So when you get to something like Angular, where everything's included, you know, I think it just makes that story easier for you to get started. You can just start building right now. You just build everything you need right now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I definitely can't like plus 1,000 that Angular has a huge advantage there. The batteries included, it, like you can't, it's such a tailwind for developers. But, you know, just to, so we're not poo-pooing all over React. We had Dan Abramov on the show last week and he shared some interesting context on this actually, which was that, you know, the way Facebook was using React wasn't, you know, initially like, oh, they're like everything in Facebook.com was built off of React, right? Like they were using it in parts of their application, right? Like, and that was, remember when React first came out, it was like, you can just add it to anywhere on your page. You know, it's okay. Add it to this legacy backbone app, add it to your Angular app, whatever, you know? And so that was just the way it was being used. And so the router really came from the community because the community was like, we love this tool. We want to build everything with it, you know? And then Create React App came to smooth over the paper cuts of the, you know, all the tooling and all of that other stuff. So interesting and very different evolution, right? But I think it speaks to just how Google's using Angular versus how React has been used internally at Meta, you know? Very different ways.
Well, and I think really quickly, like we talked about the pendulum effect. I think this is another place where we see pendulums back and forth. And it's because each approach has benefits and has drawbacks. And depending on where you're at, you want to be, you know, pick the one where the benefits are important to you and the drawbacks aren't a problem.
That's right.
Since we were talking about learning, I think the batteries included can be very helpful in that learning journey. Anyway, Jessica, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because the fact that Angular included everything used to be seen as almost like a detriment. Like everybody was like, oh, React is so much more lightweight. I have so much less to learn. But now things have pendulum swung the other way. And now people are like, well, React, there's just so much to it. And now I have to like, do I have to learn React? Who owns React? Do I have to learn Next? Where do all the tools come from? And you're starting to see a lot of these articles like, I don't know how I feel about React anymore. And just like Mark, I worked in React also before joining Google. So we have really come full circle to the point where now this is considered a strength for Angular.
Absolutely. Angular's on the right side of the argument right now, you know, lucky Angular.
We're lucky for right now, but then there'll be a time where, you know, people are like, man, Angular sucks again. You know what I mean? Like, so here's the thing.
It's just web developers, Mark. I mean, that's just the way it rolls.
We all do this.
It's just the big pendulum swing, you know?
Well, so two things I just want to throw in real quick. So Tom Hanks was in this like round table with all these other actors, right? And he goes, one thing that I learned in my career that this too will pass, right? So it will pass that we are like right now we're having a really great moment. This too will pass. We had a really bad moment. This too will pass. Same thing for React for everyone. This too will pass. If you stay in the game long enough, you will just be up and down. That is just the way that it goes. And we have to kind of like give a lot of grace. And the second thing is this. Even though I said what my personal experience was, I can still objectively acknowledge that as a web developer, you are in such good hands with almost anything that you choose. Because everything is great. Literally, everything is great. React is great. Angular is great. Vue is great. Svelte is great. Solid is great. You know, Red, I think it's called Redwood or something like that. That's like...
It's a React full stack thing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they're doing great stuff. HTMX is doing great stuff, like, quick. Everything is great. So the only mistake that you can make as a web developer, I think right now, is not choosing something and getting to work. Right? Get to work and build something great.
Amen to that. I mean, and, you know, really, like, just to click into this, like, complexity pendulum swing a little bit, and that's a great point, Mark. Like, how did we get here, right? Like, if we just take a step back, right? So we got here because, well, like, folks initially just wanted flexibility, but then flexibility comes with, you know, its own trade-offs, right? Like, and not only that, like the all-in-one model, right? Like Node versus Bun is maybe a good example here, just to kind of shift out of the front-end frameworks, right? Node is this like Legoland, composable, building block kind of ecosystem. And, you know, Bun is like, oh, we're going to wrap it all in one. But, you know, the difference, though, is that like the maintenance burden for something like Bun is like very different now than like maintaining Node, right? Just from an implementer's perspective. And like, I don't know, just like, there's power in like hedging your bets with open source, right? Like pulling from many different things and having like hedging your bets on like, okay, this community isn't so burnt out yet. Like, you know, like, so I'm going to use this tool, right? But going all in one is like putting all of your eggs in one basket. And you just have to make sure that like that ecosystem has the, like, that they're going to be able to support all of those eggs, right? Like you don't want to, right? So those are the trade-offs that you're typically like evaluating. And, you know, it's really just have to optimize for like where you are as an engineering team. You know, how much staff you have, how much bandwidth you have, you know, it's just, there's so many things that you're optimizing for. But they definitely, each of those things comes with like a trade-off, right? Like all in one versus like choose your own adventure.
You know? So. And then you said between Bun and Node, think about Webpack. Webpack was like masterfully composable, right? You can literally find a plugin for anything.
Right.
And now you look at a Webpack like configuration file, it is like, ugh, scary hours. Correct. Like, I don't even know what to do. Like, literally, because it's so flexible.
Right. And that's the other like, deep going the deep end of the flexibility. Like, the Webpack is a great example to use. But anyways.
Yeah, you know, with all these, like, eggs that we have out there with the framework, really, like, whatever framework you pick, the sunny side is up.
Jesus. Okay, for those who don't know Jessica, she's like literally the pun master.
I'm the punder woman.
I do remember when I first learned JavaScript, and even jQuery was a revelation. So It is, if you're learning JavaScript for the first time right now, or you're getting into web development for the first time, there is just so much goodness out there. And from an individual perspective, if you learn one of these frameworks and you go deep on it, and it turns out that you get a new job where that's not the framework of choice, many of the underlying concepts will transfer. Right? Syntax changes are easy. Understanding what is a router, understanding component architectures and how to design reusable components, all those things are skills that you can learn in any one of these frameworks that will carry you through all of these frameworks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's a good point. Excellent point.
So getting close to the end of our time together, are there any other Angular things that y'all want to share? Or I'm kind of curious, you mentioned something in the pre-show about a band?
Yeah, so I think Mark and I might consider starting a band together. It would be Mark Texan and the Punder Woman, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah.
We're thinking about that. Mark has some other ideas for the name of the band.
I like that name. I think it's a good name. I think so. Jessica and I, We worked so well together, and our like relationship has blossomed so much since we started working together. Just from like common like things, we both are into videography and photography, and then found out that for some time we both lived in the same neighborhood. Didn't know at the same time lived in the same neighborhood. Then we moved again when we lived in California. We lived in the same neighborhood again, unintentionally, right? And then like all these things happened, and so anytime I get to work with Jessica, it's just a real treat. And I love when she gets to cameo in videos. Here's the fun thing about Jessica. She's so busy working on framework stuff, but I'm like, hey, there's a video opportunity. Would you like to do this thing? And she always makes time. Aww. And her videos are always amongst the most popular whenever we post them because she's so creative and so funny.
Aww. Thank you, Mark. It's adorable.
It's true. All right, now say nice things about me. Go ahead.
Just joking. Mark, do not. Mark is certainly a colleague.
Can we do me next? Just kidding.
All right, that was good. See, this is what I'm saying. Jessica's really funny.
She's hilarious. She's too funny for her own good. Honestly, like, it's like Jessica's not who you want to have on like a live CNN broadcast where like they're talking about like some very serious subject, because like I can't count on her to not make everyone laugh.
Either that or she's exactly the person you want.
Right. Right.
I'm the person that people would call in and complain about because they'd be like, this is a serious topic and she's making all these jokes.
Right. Right.
You know, somebody's died and, you know, she just comes up with like the perfect pun and then like, you know, just everyone breaks character. Oh, gosh.
Mm-hmm. Do not encourage her. Do not encourage her.
All right. Wait. So to close out then, what is your best JS party pun?
Oh, gosh. Here's the problem. When I'm put on the spot, it's usually like my brain goes. So I end up running into this problem of like, come up with a pun. And I'm like, no. And then like 2 seconds later, I'm like, oh, here's one. And then it's party time. So, yeah, that's my best right
now.
That
was almost a pun. Yeah.
That was
almost a pun. That was actually pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, hey, look, that was a pun. Okay. Points for Jessica.
Not my best. No, honestly, not my best.
So what's one thing you wish everyone could know about Angular that like you feel like is like either a misconception or just either something that people just don't know about?
Oh, I have one ready. Angular is not as complicated as you've been told to get started. We had a really bad tutorial.
Go to angular.dev, right?
Yeah, go to angular.dev. We had a really bad, you know, I don't say bad tutorial. We had a really complex tutorial that left a bad experience to people. We've since then moved on past that and have a great tutorial that is really user-friendly and really even beginner-friendly. Even if you don't really know a ton about web development, you can follow it. So check out angular.dev/tutorial.
I think the thing that I would say is that often we hear, oh, yeah, I used Angular years ago and I haven't touched it since. And that is the impression that people still have, because first impressions matter. But Angular is much different now. And there's quite a lot to offer and that you probably will really like. So give it a second shot since then and see what you think.
Amel, do you have any things you'd like people to know about Angular?
I feel like the team should have really considered changing the name of the framework, because it really is so different than the Angular that people knew. Like, after the 2x, or maybe, I don't know, it should have just been called something else. I know it went from AngularJS to Angular, but that would just be my like unsolicited feedback. That's probably like bad, but
no, it's good feedback. It's good feedback because when
it's so different.
When we talk internally, I always tell people, like, we did the same thing that the Wii and the Wii U did, and Nintendo made this mistake where people didn't know that Wii U was something different. We literally did the same thing, and this is a hard lesson that if there's ever a re something, we have to change the name. Like, it has to be a new framework if it is a new framework.
I'm going
to
say, though, Google and not changing names, it feels like there's got to be a, if not a first, at least a landmark.
Yeah. Angular is probably Google's longest standing, most successful product outside of Google search, if I had to guess. And G Suite. You know what I mean? Like, let's be real. Like, the legacy is amazing, you know? So.
No comment?
No comment. Okay.
All right. I think with that, we got to shut this ship down. All right. Thank you, Jessica. Thank you, Mark. It's been delightful. Amel, as always. And let us roll. I'm K-Ball, and this has been JS Party.
If you enjoyed the first hour and 10 minutes of this conversation, you'd probably enjoy the after party where things got even punnier.
I think that's enough cheese for now, and we gotta wrap this thing.
So Come on, bro.
Otherwise it'll curdle.
Yeah. Let me off of this podcast. Let me out. I want to go home.
Do they ever let Mark off the podcast? Our Changelog Plus Plus members can stick around to find out right after this. If you aren't a Plus Plus member, now is a great time to sign up and directly support our work with your hard-earned cash or your employer-sponsored education budget. Even better. Learn all about it at changelog.com/plus.
Changelog Plus Plus. It's better.
Make the ads disappear, receive some free stickers for your laptop, and of course, get in on bonus content like this that's for Plus Plus ears only. Once again, that's changelog.com/plus.
Make your dreams come true. Just do it.
Thank you to our partners at Fly.io, to our longtime sponsors at Sentry. Save $100 on their team plan by using code CHANGELOG when you sign up at sentry.io. And to our Beat Freakin' residents, Breakmaster Cylinder, who just put the finishing touches on our new Dance Party album, which you can find by searching for Changelog Beats in your favorite music streaming platform. Give it a listen during your next coding session. I think you'll enjoy it. Next up on the pod, the JS Party gang gathers to discuss the news and welcome a brand new panelist to the show. Stay tuned right here. We'll have that episode ready for you next week.